Okay, well, with this edition of Newton Talks, we're just going to be looking entirely at Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm going to be giving my thoughts on the film after watching it once. Then I'm going to be canvassing the opinions of colleagues who are experts in cinema to see how they feel about the film too. And then I'm going to go back and watch the movie for a second time, and I'll conclude this podcast with my thoughts after watching the film for a second time. It should go without saying that there's going to be huge spoilers throughout this podcast, so if you haven't seen the film, then please stop listening now. Although if you haven't seen the film, I do wonder why you're listening to this. So as you will know, because you've seen the film, it's about a Hollywood actor, Rick Dalton, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who's sort of down on his luck, guest starring in TV action series, and looking to make films, possibly going over to Italy to make spaghetti westerns, which he doesn't really want to do. His best friend and stunt double is Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt, and Rick happens to live next door to Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. When I first heard about this movie and I first heard what Quentin Tarantino was planning, what the storyline sort of was going to be, that it was set around the kind of Charles Manson crimes with the Manson family, I was really intrigued by how he was going to pull all the threads together. On the one hand, you had these fictional characters like Rick and Cliff, as well as actors playing real people, some of whom tragically were murdered, people like Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring, for example. And also, how was Tarantino going to deal with the Manson family and the issue of Charles Manson and all the history of that episode? How was he going to bring all these threads together? It sounded utterly fascinating. It sounded really original, and I can't really think of a film quite like this. But what were my thoughts? Well, I had the very strange experience of loving this movie from beginning to end on a moment by moment basis, but also being actually quite disappointed. Because I didn't think that Tarantino brought all those threads together in a way that I would have liked him to do. Now, he made the film that he wanted to make, so there can be no criticism there. But it wasn't quite what I wanted him to do with the film. I expected the different threads to come together far more effectively in the second half, which they do in several of his other films, in particular Inglourious Basterds, for example, which this kind of resembles in that it's a kind of alternative history of real life events. Tarantino, in the first part of this film, I don't know if you agree, sets up some really brilliant scenes that you really hope will pay off in the second half. Terrific stuff building up Rick Dalton's potential career switch over to Italy to star in spaghetti westerns, Italian westerns. And also Cliff's interactions, the stuntman's interactions with the Manson family on the Spahn Ranch, which is just a wonderful scene, very kind of creepy, got really effective horror overtones, as well as using kind of Western archetypes and iconography and convention, and bringing those two things together, utterly fascinating. But I felt that the second half of the film sort of just threw all that away, and we have this voiceover that tells us what's happening on screen. He tells us that Rick has been a success in Italy. It tells us what they, how his relationship with Cliff develops, that he got married. But we don't see any of that happening. So it's very much a case of telling us and not showing us, which I didn't think was as effective. And then there's no real connection between Rick and Cliff and the Manson family, other than that chance meeting in part one, when the family turn up to commit the murders, when Tex Watson arrives with Squeaky Fromm to kill Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring at Terry Melcher's house, it's all a complete coincidence. The scene could have worked just as well even if you hadn't have had the earlier scene where Cliff has the encounter with the Manson family at the Spahn Ranch, and I found that a little bit disappointing. But the events are still entertaining. I still very much enjoyed what was happening on a moment-by-moment basis. And the climax, you know, it's a lot of fun, very violent, and overall very enjoyable. And the final scene, people have mentioned that the final scene is actually quite moving in some respects, and I guess it is. You know, I liked it, but I expected more. I wanted more. What the second half does, and the voiceover does, is that it builds a timeline towards these awful events that you know are going to happen, or at least a version of them is going to happen. I was out with some friends the other evening, and they were thinking about going to watch this movie. They asked me what I thought, and I said, I think it's terrific. And then one of them asked, how much does the Charles Manson figure fit into the story? And two of the other friends said, well, who's Charles Manson? And I thought, well, if you don't know who Charles Manson is, if you don't know the backstory of this film, I'm not sure what you'll get from the second half of this movie. If you don't know what happened to J.C. Sebring and Sharon Tate and everyone else in that house, then the ending of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood could come as a real shock. And not in a good way, but just like, what's going on here? Why have they all of a sudden turned up with these intentions? Because it doesn't really outline what the philosophy of the Manson family was. Charles Manson himself only appears in one scene. So the climax, the last half an hour, the last 40 minutes of the movie, for me only really works if you've got a really good understanding of what Charles Manson and the Manson family, what his followers did. Manson himself, of course, didn't commit any of the murders. So I found it a little bit kind of disappointing that there wasn't enough build-up there around that. And I urge these friends of mine to look, before you go and watch it, please read up a little bit about the Manson family and what happened. And then you'll get a sense, a far greater sense of what's happening in that second half of the film. What it does do, though, is if you do know what happens in the real story, in history, then it is actually quite tense. When Tarantino is letting us know what's happening, what restaurants they went to, what time they left, what time they were at their house, we get a sense of, well, he's building up here to the events of the actual evening, to what actually happened. And that sort of works in building some tension. But it's not a particularly satisfying tension. I was kind of nervous leading up to it, but not in a way that I felt was narratively satisfying. And that, I felt, was the reason why, after watching it for the first time, I was disappointed in this movie, despite also really enjoying it. It's quite unusual to be in that situation. So what was good about this film? Well, I love westerns, and I love spaghetti westerns in particular. So I really like seeing the mocked up film posters of Rick Dalton's Italian career, particularly the one that kind of is a spin on the Burt Reynolds Sergio Corbucci movie Navajo Joe. In this film, it's called Comanche Uprising. And the poster features Rick Dalton with his kind of head in the turf, with somebody stamping on the side of his face, and the poster for Navajo Joe is very, very similar. There's also a reference to a Sergio Corbucci movie in the sequence where Sharon Tate, played by Marco Robi, goes to watch herself in the Wrecking Crew, the Matt Helm film. And in the lobby, there's a poster for a real-life spaghetti western called The Mercenary, sometimes called A Professional Gun, which I believe was from 1968, which is a terrific Sergio Corbucci western with Franco Nero. So I really like that. I love the TV western stuff, particularly the episode of Lancer, which we see quite a lot of, and all the stuff with the allusions to the black and white show that Rick Dalton was in called Bounty Law, which looks like a lot of fun. The film was also extremely funny throughout. You've got all the performances are absolutely perfect, and Brad Pitt as Cliff Booth, terrific performance, really kind of relaxed character, just a wonderful character. I mean, you could watch this character, I think, in many other films, in many other scenarios. It's a real shame they're only going to get this one film of them together. And I also like the fact that Tarantino is still a bit of a provocateur. So you may have heard about the controversy around his portrayal of Bruce Lee. the actor Mike Mo plays Bruce Lee in this film, who gets into a fight with Cliff Booth on the set of The Green Hornet. The controversy has been around whether Cliff could have beaten up Bruce Lee, or whether Bruce Lee was quite as arrogant in real life as he appears in the movie, whether he would actually have fights with people, or whether he would provoke fights with people, or whether he would brag about his own martial arts prowess. I think this is ignoring the fact that this is a fictional retelling, and it's Tarantino's kind of spin on it and version of it. So I think it's entirely justified from an artistic perspective. And it's also, it's not as if Bruce Lee loses the fight. It's, you know, I'd call it very much a draw. I was at a conference once, and an academic said that she didn't think that Tarantino could write women, that his films were ridiculous, and she didn't like them because he couldn't write women. And I just thought this was a really strange statement to me, because the women in Tarantino's films talk exactly as they're supposed to talk. They don't exist unless Tarantino writes them. Tarantino, I don't understand why he is being... while reality is supposed to be the standard by which he's judged. The women in Tarantino's movies, in fact, everyone in Tarantino's movies, talk exactly as they're supposed to talk, because he wrote them, because they don't exist outside of the world of his movies. Now, with Bruce Lee, admittedly, that's slightly more complex. Do we have to have a responsibility as a filmmaker to portray somebody in an accurate way? Well, maybe, maybe not. I'm undecided. Either way, I love the fact that it was a very provocative scene. It's a very funny scene. It's a great action scene, and it's one of the highlights of the movie. As I said earlier, I'll be back later to talk about how I felt about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood after I've seen it for a second time. But now I want to talk to some colleagues about how they felt when watching the movie. Okay, so here I am talking to Lee Kenny. Lee's an expert in film and a journalist who currently lives in New Zealand. And so I'm talking to him via Skype, so the sound quality does reflect that. Lee, what were your thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
My thoughts are mixed. I don't know if that's useful to you. And some real highs and some real lows for me. Perhaps explain why. I mean, firstly, it looked sensational, and in a way, it was a real pleasure to watch. And my kind of interest in cinema, in many ways, coincided with Pulp Fiction and that kind of mid-90s scene, I guess, where films were very self-aware and kind of very referential. And always felt quite kind of grateful to Tarantino in a way that kind of his films were almost a little bit like an education. So I've been a fan for a long time, but at the same time, feel a little bit as if I kind of fell out of love with his films as well. So it's been a long time since I saw a Tarantino movie and really enjoyed it in the way that I enjoyed parts of this. It looked incredible. The recreation of 69 was just, you know, just a pleasure to see.
And it almost seemed flawless as well. Like watching it, me watching it again, I was, for the second time I was watching it, I was looking at the background, looking at the cars, trying to pick out bits that didn't look period. And I'm not an expert on that, but it looked flawless. Mm.
And some huge big wide shots as well. I mean, it's not as if this kind of stuff was done, you know, kind of cheaply. It all looks very It looks very real. So kind of take my hat off to him for that. And there's a fairly early scene where you kind of see Brad Pitt just kind of driving off on a blue sports car. And it's incredible. I mean, I could have watched it. If that scene had been 10 minutes long, it wouldn't have been long enough.
Yeah.
So, parts of it I really liked. But then if I kind of cut to the ending, which is the stuff I kind of disliked the most. I mean, had the film finished with them flying back from Italy, I'd have been much happier. But what we've got with Tarantino now is this very strange desire to rewrite history. And it's really odd that he's kind of positioned himself in this place where it's the kind of third occasion now where, you know, having seen black slaves blow up a plantation, a group of American Jews kill Hitler, and now having seen his Hollywood stuntman avert the Tate massacre. It's a very strange thing for him to be doing. And I struggled with it, really. I really struggled with the ending. But I'm happy to kind of to have enjoyed the parts I enjoyed a lot. But ultimately, you know, it throws some real questions. Now, it's interesting that there is a filmmaker in Hollywood that's got the desire and the influence and the kind of idiosyncrasies to be doing that. So, you know, all praise to the guy for at least, you know, doing something different. But it's very strange how he's kind of almost created this role for himself as this avenging angel. This kind of weird cinematic, like, quantum leap where he's kind of going back and rewriting the wrongs of history. Very, very strange. Obviously, he's interested in that period. He's interested in those murders, but told them in such a strange way. How did you feel about that? Because I mean, we haven't kind of talked about this at all. It feels like the kind of thing that we'd, you know, devote many an hour in the pub talking about. But how does that kind of sit with you? The ending, the intervention into history.
The revisionism I really love. I don't know of anybody else that's doing anything quite like that, and I don't know of a film that is quite like this. I'm racking my brains to think of a film that's like this. You know, it's probably closer to something like, you know, that used to be a kind of a sitcom called Star Stories. I don't know if you remember that in England Kevin Bishop. It's more like that when they've got kind of, you know, people playing famous caricatures of famous people and kind of like retelling history. But at the same time, I do really, really like it. However, it's not done particularly satisfyingly in this. I think part of the reason is because we're not really given any background on what Manson's up to or what his followers are up to. Whereas it's pretty clear that in Django Unchained and in Inglourious Basterds, that the villains are the villains. We know who they are. In this, there's nothing to establish them as villains until the very end moment, so I don't think it works as a kind of narrative device in this one. At the same time, I do like what he's trying to do with it. But I agree with you, it's strange. And if you say it's strange, but do you dislike it? If you dislike it, what do you dislike about it?
I hate to be the guy that's like staring at a picture in a gallery, scratching his head, saying, "I don't get it." and I'm fine with art throwing up maybe more questions than answers. But genuinely, James, I just don't understand what he hopes to achieve. I don't understand the point of it. And why not make the definitive exploration of that time and that period and those murders, if that's what he wants to do, as opposed to using it as this weird opportunity to put right these, you know, these injustices. And even from a very practical point of view, let's say the universe played out in the way that he's dreamt that it could have, does that mean that Charles Manson didn't go to prison? Because like the actual consequences of like, you know, his character's intervention, that means that Charles Manson never went to prison, right? Because, you know, what links him to those? Well, for a start, there were no murders. And, you know, what even links him to the three that were killed? So
some would argue that Manson shouldn't have been in prison in the first place, given the fact he didn't commit any of the murders himself. But,
Yeah, well, I wonder. I mean,
that's
not
my argument,
like,
necessarily. I just mean that some would argue that it's very strange how they've gone and gotten by proxy. And it's like, but Manson, he obviously just floats in. He's got one scene in this film. It's very... Yeah, I agree with you, it's odd. I mean, it's... Can I ask you a question then? Did you watch Wonder Woman?
Yes.
Yeah. So how do you feel about something like the intervention there, where she kind of like solves World War One and just... solves the trenches by just stepping out with a big shield? Is that? I'm not trying to challenge you what your opinion here, because I know it's a bit of a left field question. But that to me, I thought was maybe more troubling than this. I don't know why. I think maybe I'm the one who's a hypocritical or kind of contradictory here.
Yeah, there's always a problem when they try to like locate narrative fiction in a real world setting, and you know, why doesn't Superman fly around the world and take away everybody's guns and make it a safer place? Like, so yeah. It is difficult. And
I suppose he tries that in Superman 4 when he decides to get rid of all the nuclear weapons.
And look how that went. But I suppose these films, that they can only ever have this kind of brush with history, can't they? And I can't remember the extent to which Wonder Woman resolves World War One. But yeah, that's always the question, you know. Yeah, if she's there for World War One, where was she for World War II? And yeah. I guess that's the complication that these people have.
I think
when they try to closely align it with history.
In the explanation in Wonder Woman, she just said, "Oh, these people are so bad, fuck them," you know, and then she doesn't come back till the end of the century. I think that was
I mean, I don't mind that, as long as it's acknowledged. You can't question, you know, their motivations, but at least they've gone so far as to acknowledging that it's a problem narratively. And it's, I mean, but I guess in the case of this, and in the case of Inglourious Basterds, he's deliberately... So from what I've read since, we now have to kind of think of the Tarantino films as existing in this alternate reality. In that case, that's fine. Everything's fine. And supposedly, so if you said to Mr. Pink in Reservoir Dogs, who killed Adolf Hitler, he'd say, well, he was gunned down by a group of American Jews, wasn't he? That's become the history there, hasn't it? But also a history where there's Madonna, and also a history where there's Silver Surfer comics. So it's a complicated history. But if he wants to go down that route, that's fine. Interestingly, the one film that he doesn't include within his historical timeline is Jackie Brown, which for me, you know, still remains his best film, or certainly my favourite of his films, which, you know, in a way is quite telling. In terms of let's say we kind of buy into the fact that he's created this... almost superhero-like character who can beat up Bruce Lee, don't forget, and lives behind a drive-in movie theatre. Even though he's created this character, it's still done in quite an unsatisfactory way. You know, they said it didn't rescue Sharon Tate. It was more that, you know, they kind of blindly stumbled into these events, as opposed to, you know... heroically saving them. So it's so even though he's decided that he wants to create this kind of ultimate Hollywood stuntman movie character who's going to save the day, even that doesn't feel very satisfying. Even that's done in a kind of clunky, silly, you know, funny way.
Yeah, it's a joke. It's like it comes across like Monty Python, Life of Brian. Like they accidentally go to the wrong, you know, the wrong person gets called the Messiah rather than, you know, it's all rather than them kind of, as you say, there's no real tying in the first part of the movie with the second part of the movie. It's just a pure coincidence that they turn up there, and it's their car's really noisy, isn't it? And that's why so Rick goes out there, gives them a load of shit, and then they decide to pick on him rather than the next door. So I agree with you. It is peculiar, and I felt it when I first watched it. Yeah, it was unsatisfactory when I first saw it. I know that you're not as into, let's say, into Westerns as I am. So how did you feel during those long, lengthy scenes where he's supposed to be in the pilot episode of Lancer, and he's playing that character, Caleb? I'm talking about Leonardo DiCaprio's character. And it's those kind of long scenes of him... As in this kind of TV Western, but just played almost straight, apart from the odd instructions you can hear coming off screen. What did you feel about those scenes?
Yeah, loved that stuff. Really enjoyed it. And it was kind of weird watching it in a fairly busy cinema in Christchurch when they showed those scenes. They were getting some quite big laughs, which I don't imagine was the intention, because presumably those that stuff's in there because Tarantino loves it. Very enjoyable stuff. Okay. Really enjoyed that stuff. And the movie set stuff was great. Mm. And he's created an interesting character, a kind of this old cowboy actor who's kind of no longer feels like he's in step with the world, which, to be honest, has already been done by Toy Story over four films. But he's like Woody from the 50s. He's kind of out of step with an advance in Hollywood, changing world. So yeah, enjoyed all that stuff as well. And had it just been a story about a drunken actor and his stuntman mate, I think it would have just been a lot easier to enjoy, because there is so much of it to enjoy. But yeah, it's just complicated by the ending, really. So yeah, as I said, I mean, had it ended when they fly back from Italy, because I imagine, you particularly loved all that stuff of him going out to Italy and,
yep,
living the high life there, coming back with an Italian wife and things like that. There's really good drama. And the Western stuff, where Tarantino plays it like a Western when he goes out to Spawn Ranch, and, mm-hmm, really exciting, but almost a waste. A really good character. In a really exciting location, going out and meeting members of the Manson family and going to the house was great. One of the most exciting Tarantino scenes that I've watched in a long time. But ultimately, I can't say I enjoyed the whole film, but there was lots to enjoy.
Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Chris Deasy, who's runs a course in film and religion, and who is a Tarantino fan, long-standing Tarantino fan, and an expert in his work. Chris, what were your thoughts on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
I was a little disappointed, if I'm honest, until the end. Now, I saw Jackie Brown again at the cinema 20 years after the original viewing, just a few weeks ago. And that reinforced my sense that this was Tarantino at his best, that he sort of, everything went together. It was kind of seamless. That film worked because he had the kind of dialogue from Pulp Fiction, mm-hmm, which was a little bit surreal and hyper-real, but mixed with real-world situations. And these characters seem to be fleshed-out versions of what you got in Pulp Fiction, and a clear narrative arc and a brilliant soundtrack. When I saw this film, I was so looking forward to it, but it seemed to meander. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it took me a while to sort of get a sense of where, there were part real characters. Polanski, I wasn't expecting Polanski to appear in that, or somebody playing Polanski. I knew that Charles Manson was going to be part of that narrative, and by definition Sharon Tate. But the two main characters, of course, are fictitious, but set in, and they're sort of like sitting around, wannabe actors or TV stars who, I think, isn't their ultimate aspiration seems to be sort of go to enough pool parties that Polanski will put them in his next movie. And then, of course, then it's sort of art meets life. Now, anyone listening to this who doesn't know the ending might not want to hear what I say, and the same goes for Inglourious Basterds. But in that film, of course, what was clever is that you think you know where it's going to go, and then when Hitler is assassinated, you think, whoa, hang on, and by Brad Pitt, so a common link with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you're watching it and you're thinking, that's not what happened. And you think, but hang on a minute, Tarantino is not making a piece of cinema verity. I mean, actually, if he ever did a Jesus film, can you imagine how that would go? It would be blasphemous to the hilt, but at least it would probably be, a cinema making go, as it would be groundbreaking. So, in this film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, all the way through it, I was thinking, I know it's, like 20 minutes to go, and I was thinking, but we know what happens. We know that Sharon Tate is murdered and she's 8.5 months pregnant. So, but I was thinking, is it just going to end on that note? But of course, the ending completely revisited history. And I can't even say he created a happy ending out of it, because, of course, Polanski is still alive. The tragedy of what happened in August 69 is almost then just almost like being rewritten as a cinematic experience. And I was so conflicted by that, but I thought it was brilliant bravado. And it made me then think, maybe I should see the whole film in that light. So the review that I wrote afterwards was really sort of positive, because it was like I was wrong-footed by the ending, even though he did a similar thing in Inglourious Basterds. So the ending was so unexpected that I was kind of excited by that. But in the 2 hours before that, I'm not going to deny, I did feel that it was going into different places. I couldn't get a hold on the characters in the way that Jackie Brown, from the very outset, I felt I had invested something emotionally in the Pam Grier character, and Robert Forster as the bail bondsman. So, and even the supporting characters there seem to have a bit of a backstory. This one may warrant a repeat viewing. I'm sure I will watch it again soon. But as I say, it was like a film in two parts, a long meandering bit and the most audacious of endings. And I didn't see it coming. And that, I think, on the whole, made me want to give it a more positive rating.
What were your thoughts in terms of what somebody would get out of this if they didn't know the history of Manson?
Well, what I thought was interesting is that I'm in my mid-40s and there were people in the audience significantly younger than me. And I don't know how many of the people who were watching it in that screening that I was at would know the story or know it well enough to know that Sharon Tate was murdered at 8.5 months pregnant. So they may not have seen that film and realised what Tarantino had done, unless, and if the film didn't even flag up the fact that, you know, she died in August 69, whatever. So it was more a case that if you don't know what happened, the film can work on its own terms, but it gives you a very distorted, but very sort of, you know, Tarantino is very good at executing on the screen kind of his sort of fantasies, you know, the film that you think of Reservoir Dogs as well, and, you know, the way that they bring Madonna into it in the sort of conversation at the beginning, but then you don't know where it's going to go and everything is sort of out of time and fast forward and going back and sort of seeing the same event in Pulp Fiction, certainly from different perspectives. So we know that he's a very audacious filmmaker, but if you don't know that story, if you don't know what happened, the tragedy of 1969, I don't know what you'd make of the film. If I hadn't known that, then I would have found the film to be a bit of a letdown, I suspect.
Yeah, I think he does, at risk of repeating myself, because I've already done an introduction to this, I think he does something really interesting if you do know the story, in that in some ways it's narratively weak, in that he's got, I think Kurt Russell does a voiceover in the second half telling us what's happened and where Sharon Tate and the rest are having dinner. They leave at this particular time and they go back to the house at this particular time, and I think you see the times appear on the screen, and I thought this is really clunky until after 10 minutes of that, and I thought actually what this is doing is counting down to one of a truly horrific event that happens in history, right? And you're thinking it's actually a bit cleverer than what I originally suspected here, because if you are knowing the story, it's almost like it's got a kind of Crime Watch feel to it, you know, oh my god, we're heading actually to this is the night, right? And maybe it is still clunky, but it also, I thought it worked more subtly than what I initially gave it credit for in the first time I watched it. I thought that was interesting. What it doesn't do is it doesn't set up the Manson family as any kind of villains of any kind of note right until the end. And he's got that line about I'm here to do the devil's business, which is just from reality apparently, but doesn't doesn't have any resonance whatsoever within the film, unless you. So it's almost like you have to be aware of everything that's happening outside of the film, rather than the film itself.
Yeah. It's because of what Charles Manson or his proteges did in '69 that made him infamous. And I suppose what Tarantino might have been doing is presenting it as a sort of, at the time, through the lens of these kind of, you know, acid-tripped wannabe sort of, you know, TV actors or TV actor and his stunt double. They were oblivious to all of that.
Yeah,
and I suppose it was sort of saying that in hindsight, we know what happened, and it was outrageous and it was tragic. But at the time, if anybody had known that that was going to happen, then they would have stopped it. But I suppose almost it's saying that they stopped it by accident, and that line that was read out to the Brad Pitt character about I'm doing the devil's business, of course, is then almost for laughs, because he responds in a sort of, you know, it's almost as though he thinks that they're just referring to something that was said on a different occasion, and he goes, no, that wasn't it was a different line altogether. And it's like this amazing and like powerful line, like he's going to go and they're going to go murder Sharon Tate, you know, it was just almost like played for laughs. And therefore it did feel that Tarantino was blurring the line in a way that I thought was fascinating between historicity and fantasy. And I know that he hates it when people say, do your films incite real life violence? He will not engage with those questions. And one of the films that came out was after another high school massacre, and he was asked the questions about this, and he was like, you know, there is no correlation. You know, don't blame me for something that happens outside that filmic universe. I'm responsible for that cinematic fantasy. Don't bring a real life situation and expect me to A, comment on it, and B, have to defend my film in that light. So he clearly doesn't like it when people try and get him to comment about the real life implications of what he's doing. He's sort of making the films as he wants them to be made, so he'll create his own happy ending or otherwise, and in terms of his idiosyncratic vision. But to do that with someone like Polanski, who is still alive and who is also a filmmaker, and apparently did make contact with Polanski or Polanski's agent, just to check, you know, actually what he was doing here. I think that
and the Tate family as well, I think.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Indeed, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting, because Polanski is, of course, for many people, known notoriously for what happened 8 years later with the case of the statutory rape. And it's interesting that there was a line in the film about when Brad Pitt's character checks the age of one of the girl he looks like he's about to have sex with, and asks her if she has a driving license so he can verify that she is over 17 or 18 or whatever. So that was clearly a nod to Polanski.
You've also got the Steve McQueen character looking across at Polanski from a party, and he says something on when that little prick Polanski fucks up, or something along something along those lines. When he does, the other character, Jay Sebring, will be there to kind of pick up the pieces. Yeah. So that's maybe another allusion to that as well. Really, I thought that was really. How did you get on with the? You said it was meandering. How did you get on with the TV Western stuff when he's making the episode of Lancer?
Yeah. That was, well, we know even in Jackie Brown, the sort of with the girls and guns, whatever it's called, you know, he's very good with the film within a film, or having a TV programme on in the background. He does it with the music. Mm. In that sense, similar to Scorsese, who's got all, you know, in Mean Streets, when you've got all the music playing. But here in Tarantino's case, it's actually playing in the car, rather than necessarily just played outside of the film and sort of imposed as, you know, the soundtrack imposed on the film. Here the characters are listening to the same thing. So we're used to all of that. I mean, some of it was sort of funny in its own right, but ultimately I did kind of feel, where is this going? And I wonder if maybe that was deliberate, and maybe it just invites a second viewing, because as I didn't see the ending. And nobody could have anticipated that ending unless they'd obviously read a review beforehand. So I'm wondering whether he was deliberately trying to sort of say, well, let's look at the film not from the eyes of the winners, if you like, but almost like the losers, or the people who are like the B-movie actors. But because they sort of, it's almost as though by accident, because they so believe their characters, believe their roles, they're then sort of using movie dialogue because they're on an acid trip, outside of the actual filmmaking. So it's almost what the Brad Pitt character does, and then Leonardo DiCaprio with the burning and setting fire and shooting and stabbing, whatever they do every, you know, and to the Manson prodigies. It's almost as though that was the sort of like the fantasy of someone who's a B-movie star who wants to be an A-star, but then almost has a chance to do something in, you know, without realizing the implications of what it is. They're sort of like that, they're so in character almost that accidentally there's this collision of the sort of like the inane B-movie scripts and then this real life tragedy. They don't know it's a real life tragedy. If they knew what was going to happen, maybe they would have freaked out and couldn't have gone through with it, but almost as though the whole thing is treated for, they just see them as like, you know, hippies who have wandered into their house, shouldn't be there, they should go and get a job or whatever, and the whole thing is almost like they misunderstand, they think that these are just, you know, people who are lost their way and maybe invading their home of an evening, and actually they have a more serious agenda, and it's that disconnect between the tragedy and the comedy that makes that scene really work. But it's almost as though you had to wait over 2 hours to get a bit of sort of classics Tarantino, quite serious, bloody violence happening on the screen. It's almost as though you had to wait a long time for something to happen that in some of his other films you get much earlier on. And then that is just before the end of the film, about 10 minutes before the end. But then you're expecting, as I was, but we know that Sharon Tate gets killed. So it's almost as though what's going to happen next is even worse than what we've just witnessed. Because here nobody died apart from the assassins. But you think, but if they're killed, then somebody, one of them ran away, didn't they? Or got into the car and
yeah.
bailed out. So I was thinking that she's going to come back, or Manson himself is going to come back. So I was thinking, where's this going to go? But then when the film did end, I thought, this is the one scenario I didn't see coming. I thought maybe Tarantino therefore is a genius, but I just didn't get it on that first viewing.
So the final two questions: what did you think was the most effective scene for you, and what did you think of the scenes with Bruce Lee?
Okay. Oh, the Bruce Lee one first. That was hilarious, because again, he's an icon who is dead and died, I think, on set, didn't he, of making a film. So it was almost as though in having this offset but kind of on-set type of relationship, you know, martial arts episode. It's almost as though it's like, well, you're the guy from the movies, but actually I can beat the shit out of you, sort of thing. So it's almost as though Bruce Lee was then sort of in character, but not on camera. And so that was just almost like funny, but almost like in bad taste, which maybe sets us up for what then happens with Sharon Tate, which arguably is in bad taste. You know, he makes her live, but, you know, what happened was a tragedy. So it's like he changed history around. So that was a very funny moment, but also maybe all the more funny because it was like, I can't believe he did that. That really is treading on, you know, sacred ground. And then the very, very end scene where it almost seemed like something out of a Polanski movie, because you have the close-up of the house and the horror music, and it sounds like something out of Rosemary's Baby, which is a reference to all of that. And so the ending, which was almost then like, this is a movie within a movie within a movie, and I was expecting it to end with lots of bloodshed, but it kind of ended in a sort of, everything's okay, all the good people are still alive, and yet they're not alive. So it was a spooky ending, and I left feeling really quite debilitated.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thanks very much for your thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, James.
Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Nigel Mather. Your thoughts?
It's a film that it's very difficult to have settled thoughts about. The title does lead us to see it as a film, you know, about the cinema, and therefore, what kind of a film is he making? You know, which again I think makes it difficult to judge. In that it is moving genres. Certainly for the opening of the film, it seems like an Antonioni movie. There's a Risky Point, which Antonioni made in 1969, in which very little happens, but we see a kind of outsider's view of Hollywood and this area, the beauty of it, the colour of it, the massive signs.
And that's made in 1969, so that's the same year that this film is
set. It's also a film about, I suppose, a genre that's maybe it's having a bit of a comeback now, but it's been dormant for many decades in many respects. That of the Western. And I noticed the reviewer in Sight and Sound, who called it ultimately a reactionary movie, wondered why, to some extent, actually Tarantino didn't just go out and make a Western, in fact, really. That he keeps going back to the Western. I think my feelings about it are not entirely formulated yet, and I suppose that is the sign of an interesting, well-made film, that you don't know entirely what to make of it. To some extent, he is an uncompromising director. And he's also, I mean, this talk about him retiring, I mean, you know, he's 4 years off 60, which I reached last year. I'm not dissimilar generation to Tarantino. But even I have difficulty remembering some of these TV shows that he's referencing, things like Mannix, you know, the FBI, which I'm not sure was even ever shown in Britain. So one of the things I sensed about the Curzon audience, really, was that they were a little bit confused. They didn't understand these references, and they weren't particularly kind of exhilarated by them. And I think it is easy to forget, and I think this is one reason why modern audience is maybe a little bit bemused by what's going on, but Tarantino, I suppose a little bit like yourself, although not quite the same, is of a generation where you couldn't just see things again. I mean, there was no question of seeing a TV show again. I mean, there would be reruns of certain things that proved to be popular, but it was a kind of one-off thing. I mean, really, pretty much the same with films, really, until, you know, video came
along. So much so that with things like Steptoe and Son, that they wipe them off. Yeah. The BBC would wipe the tapes. Or I think similar happened with Doctor Who. They show very little regard for what they were producing, it seems.
Yes. And I suppose perhaps part of what he's doing, I mean, there are interviews in Titan Town where he's talking with great enthusiasm about these TV shows that nobody remembers. And somebody did say to me, perhaps best not to name this person really, but they suggested perhaps actually Tarantino just has rather poor taste in television in a way. And this is one of the things that adds to sort of the slightly, you know, confusing element that some people have with the film, that if he was referencing Columbo or the Rockford Files or Kojak or the TV series I'm a great fan of, as was this person I was speaking to, then you could understand some of the enthusiasm in a way. And these are things that have lived on. He, you know, in his own wisdom, is more concerned with things that have been forgotten. For instance, I've always been a big Steve McQueen fan, but I've never seen a single episode of the Bounty Hunter series, which
Wanted Dead or Alive.
Wanted Dead or Alive.
They did show that, I think, later. It was a little bit later. I remember seeing that when I was either in my late teens,
or
early 20s, when they started. I don't know whether it was Channel 4 that they started putting that.
I think. I mean, Clint Eastwood had a similar thing with Rawhide, didn't he?
And it's interesting you compare it to Zabriskie Point. Now, I don't know what the critical consensus is on Zabriskie Point, but I first encountered that film reading it in that, is it Michael Medved's book, The 50 Worst Films of All Time?
Really? I didn't know it was listed in that.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose, yes, it was a commercial disaster and a critical failure, right? I mean, reevaluate a little bit now. I actually taught on a course here on American cinema. And, you know, it might have been seen as a bit of a surprising choice in a way. I mean, something like Easy Rider has lived on in a way that film hasn't. I mean, Zabriskie Point is an all-term movie, and Antonioni only got to do it because he'd done Blow Up. And he had a three-film contract with MGM, which, in fairness to them, they honoured. I mean, he later did The Passenger with Jack Nicholson, which is seen as, you know, a really, really great movie. It's a risky point, and this, I think, is the connection with Once Upon in Hollywood, really, because I think Antonioni was famed for making films about alienation and the long sequences just about the landscape in a way that he felt filmmakers didn't really look at properly. And it wasn't narratively driven, but it did have an interest, and it did begin, in fact, with student protest, about 15, 20 minutes. A pretty intelligent kind of student debate about the very troubled state of America in 1969. Things one would have to say are notably absent from this film in terms of, you know, the representation of radicalism or whatever. I don't think the Vietnam War is mentioned in the film. It then becomes, I suppose, the question of the treatment or whatever. And there is a kind of link with Psycho, really, because Hitchcock asked the critics not to give away the twist ending, you know, that Norman and Mrs. Bates are one. And it's very hard to recapture that moment now, really, because I think everybody knows, really, the story. But from all accounts, people who saw it originally had no idea that that was coming. And I think the link here, and I think, you know, it was good that this secret was kept in a way. That clearly we don't get what we expect at the end. And I suppose a couple of questions here as to, you know, why he's doing this, what is achieved by this, is it successful? Not really, I think, necessarily in questions of just moral taste or whatever. I mean, I think he's meaning well in this. But is it, as some people have said, is it just trite and silly, really, and kind of futile to end it in this way, where Shantae doesn't die? And in a sense, everybody, you know, this is the Once Upon a Time, I suppose, element of the title, everybody seems to possibly live on happily or whatever.
But I think it's remarkable, and I think the critics talking about, or isn't outlining what the Manson family were, it's the film is seen through the eyes of Cliff and Rick.
Right.
They think they're hippies. They don't think they have any kind of further depth.
Right.
And so
right.
There's no reason for the film to explain any further depth, because the film isn't about the Manson family. It's not about Sharon Tate. The film's about Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton. That's what the film's about.
Yes.
And I think people, again, people wanted it to be about something that it isn't. Then you just mentioned about the Bruce Dern's cameo.
Yes.
Maybe there's something you want to say about how you felt Bruce Dern was used in this, and why he was an important figure for the 1960s, or
to me,
60s into 70s.
To me, this is one of the stranger scenes in the film, really. And at this stage, I'd have to say I'm not convinced it's a scene that would improve on reviewing. I mean, I'd be happy to be kind of proved wrong here in a way. And I suppose just to say what happens before that. I mean, it is a very well handled sequence in itself. I think where Brad Pitt goes to this place, he senses something isn't right, as we all do, but it's not quite clear what it is. I mean, it seems to be something about female evil at this stage. And Dakota Fanning gives, you know, a very impressive impersonation of somebody who is, you know, quite daunting or whatever as a member of this family. But it is a very kind of bizarre scene, because she's set up as a member of this cult, but the cult is also presented as, like everybody else in the film, like Cliff and the Leonardo DiCaprio character, as being obsessed with television. I mean, whether this was the case or what kind of point she's trying to make here, I'm not quite sure. But even she talks about, you know, the FBI story and Bonanza. And I don't know, I suppose this might be a question of Tarantino as a writer here as well. And I suppose he is, you know, important to keep in mind, he is writing, directing, and, you know, to a certain extent producing. He has an awful lot of control. I just felt it was a scene that seemed to me something of a dead end in a way, really. That we're led to think that something quite auspicious is, you know, behind this hidden door, that the Dern character is dead, he's tied up, he's been kept a prisoner here. And to some extent, you know, I suppose the implication is, you know, he is kind of being a hostage, you know, to their taking over of the ranch or whatever. Although there is that strange line, I won't quote it exactly as it is in the film, where the Dakota gang character says, you know, he's going to be a bit tired because we've been, you know, having sex for hours and hours or whatever. You know, again, seems a little bit difficult to believe when we do see Bruce Dern.
I mean, he did in real life, though. Manson ordered his followers to have sex with
George Spahn. Even with dying blind men or whatever.
Well, according to what I've read about it, that was the case. Yeah, so his followers had sex with
and him. That would be the reason that Dern's character, not that he was in a position to do very much, was not kicking up a fuss about what was happening. From what I read in Sight and Sound, Burt Reynolds was meant to play this part, and then Reynolds passed away, and Dern was a friend. And Bruce Dern, for a brief while, was a very important figure in kind of new Hollywood cinema. He kills John Wayne in the back in The Cowboys. I think this was the first film that Wayne had died in this fashion, in 1971. And, you know, that's a sign of Hollywood changing. You know, at a certain kind of time, Wayne would not have agreed to something like that. He has a very good role in a film called Silent Running at the time, a kind of science fiction movie, a very moving movie, really, where he's a very kind of lonely spaceman. Really.
And it's a countercultural kind of film as well.
Yes, absolutely.
It's about saving ecology and things like that.
Absolutely. He appears in a wonderful film, not very well known, called The King of Marvin Gardens with Jack Nicholson. He has a seminal role in The Great Gatsby, you know, that quintessential American novel, opposite Robert Redford. And at the end of the decade, he appears. The film's just come out on Blu-ray again. It's kind of been talked about again, but forgotten for a long time. A film called Coming Home by Hal Ashby, which is about the Vietnam War, and Dern is a soldier who comes home to find that, you know, his wife is having an affair with somebody who's been badly injured in the war, and you know, the final scene of the film is a kind of Bruce Dern's character walking off into the sea, killing himself. And Dern, you know, still working today, but that decade was the kind of high point for him. So I think he represents an awful lot of series of tensions around American society and culture. Never a major star, but always, I think, you know, lifted any kind of movie he appeared in. And I was looking forward, I read that, you know, Bruce Dern was in this film. But I don't know what your response was. I just felt, well, none of this seemed to be kind of echoed in how Tarantino was using him. I mean, I know it was not written with him in mind. But it just seemed narratively something of a dead end. Perhaps not, you know, the best use might have been made of Bruce Dern.
Nigel Mather, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so I've managed to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for a second time now. And I loved it more the second time than I did the first. I think it was less jarring the second, the narrative shifts in the second half of the movie, after Rick and Cliff come back from Italy. It's far less jarring the second time that you watch it. I admit the first time did cause a bit of trepidation in me, but the second time watching it, you expect it, so you can enjoy those moments for what they are, rather than being a little bit disoriented with what was happening. I noticed really that the narrative of the film takes place over quite a short space of time. I didn't realise this when watching it the first time. It actually takes place over just, I think, one full day in two half days. So even though it's a very long movie, 2 hours and 30 minutes or something like that, 2 hours 40, it actually takes place over a very short space of time. Two full days, although of course we do have this 6 months hiatus in the middle which we see flashbacks of. I really liked in the Lancer episode where that Rick Dalton is shooting the Lancer pilot, the subtle camera movement that Tarantino is pulling off, which are very TV-like. So in a movie you get far more cuts, but TV shows from around that time would have had far fewer different camera setups, and the camera moves in really subtly in and out around the table where Rick Dalton and Timothy Oliphant character are kind of verbally sparring, drinking their, I think it's tequila. So I really like the film a second time. How it fits in the kind of the pantheon of Tarantino's work, I'm not sure. It would need more viewings, because with Tarantino's films, I come back to them again and I become more affectionate towards them, and then I get less affectionate towards them. It normally varies. So it seems to me that many of the criticisms of this movie are not actually pointing out flaws, but are actually just a matter of taste. A lot of the criticism that I've seen is just pointing out material that is there on purpose, but the critic doesn't like. For example, the voiceover in the second half of the film that just kind of almost appears from out of nowhere. We do get one very small instance of it very early on in the film when we hear that Rick Dalton has had a DUI. But when that comes into the second half of the film far more prominently, it is a narrative shortcut. There's no question about that. But Tarantino, I don't think, cares. It's not a flaw in that he's done it by mistake or he doesn't know how to get himself out of a situation. He just doesn't care. He's presenting the bits that he wants to present and gives us the right amount of information, or what he considers to be the correct amount of information, for us to be able to enjoy the movie. Likewise with the Bruce Lee scenes, which have attracted controversy. Tarantino doesn't care. People might not like it, but I don't necessarily see that as a flaw in the movie. I think this is exactly the film that he wanted to make. So I think much of the criticism is purely a matter of taste. I absolutely get why people don't rate
of the movie as a whole or parts of it. I get why they think it's narratively lazy. I can get why they might think that it's offensive. But I don't think that that's a criticism. I don't think that's incompetence in the material, because I don't think the material is incompetent. I think this is a $100 million or whatever the budget was art movie, and we don't get many of those. And to reiterate, I don't think I've seen another film quite like this. I can't think of a film that resembles this in any way. It's a very personal piece of work, whilst also being quite an accessible piece of work. It's extraordinary in what it is trying to do. That doesn't mean it's good, but it's extraordinary. And for that alone, I think a really valuable contribution to cinema. So, thank you to my guests, Lee Kenny, Chris Deasy, and Nigel Mather. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Newton Talks will return.